You're listening to Changing Minds, Transformative Talks for Healthcare Improvement. Grab a coffee or tea and join our team as we chat with leaders in the academic detailing space. For more information on academic detailing, visit us at narcad.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Changing Minds podcast. This is your host, your temporary host, Bevan Amira. We all wish well to the Changing Minds podcast creator, Anna Morgan Barsamian, as she is out on maternity leave for the next 6 months. But I've promised her I will take good care of one of her other babies, which is this podcast. And in doing so, my very first guest is none other than Jerry Avorn, the originator of academic detailing. And what better guest to start things off with? Hi, Jerry. How are you doing today?
Hello, Bevan. Nice to talk with you.
Yeah, lovely to have you. And I know this will be an exciting podcast with you on it, of course. There's a lot of things we're going to catch up on in a short period of time. So let's just dive right in. So it's been over 40 years since your original studies. What are some of the things that have just, you know, made you proud and just excited and surprised you as you've seen our field evolve since those original studies?
Well, as you point out, the first paper was in New England Journal of Medicine in 1983, but the first grant on which that was based, I wrote only a couple of years out of my residency in 1979. And I wasn't even sure what a grant was, but somebody said, if you have a good idea, you send something into the federal government, and if they think it's a good idea, they send you money to do it. And I thought, okay, that's a neat idea. So in all the many decades since then, I guess what I've been most pleased to see was that an idea that was really just a gleam in the eye of a very young internist just out of training could be transformed first into a legit study that was methodologically good enough and had findings that were robust enough to make it into the New England Journal. But way more important than that, that other people saw it and said, hey, yeah, that is a good idea, and replicated it and wrote their own papers and set up their own programs. And that we went from gleam in the eye of a young doc to international programming is really pretty wonderful.
It really is. And I think one thing that I've seen just in my shorter time at NARCAD over the past 10, 11 years is just how anchored everybody is in those original studies, how well they know them, how they, you know, have them as a compass as they do their work and as they adapt their work to our changing times. It is very captain obvious to say that this year's times in particular are particularly trying, are challenging for everyone in the sphere of clinical education and beyond, of course. Curious just briefly how you might offer folks a little bit of hope during this time. Of course, you know, we can't be toxically positive, and I would never ask you to be that way because that's not your vibe, Jerry. But if you could offer just a little bit of hope to people who are struggling right now to feel that they have the capacity, the ability, and the energy to kind of face the trials and tribulations right now thrown at them, particularly here in the States. Any sprinklings or any nuggets you can throw their way?
Let me try. And that, of course, is something that we all need in these times. One nugget is that, and many of the listeners will know this, my colleague Ben Rome over at our Division of Pharmacoepi at the Brigham and Harvard Med School, along with others at ELOSA, published a paper that was kind of important and encouraging that is available, I think, at no cost on JAMA Network Open, and NARCAD has the link and can send it around, which is sort of encouraging for all of us in academic detailing who may have wondered over the years, you know, is this really working? Does it have any effect? Or have had funders say to us, particularly in these challenging times, why should we pay money for this? Who says it's any good? And what Ben did with the rest of us was pull together every known, decently done study of academic detailing. And by decently done, I mean, you know, randomized or with an adequate control group or any kind of rigorous evaluation. And he did show, as the Cochrane collaboration did back in around 2007 or so, when they reviewed the first 70 or so randomized trials of academic detailing and concluded, yes, there's evidence it works. In 2025, Ben Rome and the rest of us did a follow-up to that and concluded once again, yes, it does work in improving prescribing. There were a number of studies which are kind of interesting and creative in terms of all the different things that people were doing, including our colleagues at the VA who were well represented in those in that collection of studies, and were able to show, yeah, you do have, when you look at it, you know, in a rigorous way, an improvement in prescribing. So I guess the small nugget before we get to the more challenging issues of the moment, but the small nugget is that as of 2025, there is indeed a paper in one of the JAMA journals that shows, yes, academic detailing does improve prescribing, in case there was anyone out there that was still wondering about that. In
Any
terms of,
doubters? Yes. And just really quickly, I want to say to all of our listeners, if you're wondering where that paper is, we will make sure it is linked to the podcast. And we'll also put that one from 2007 so you can see the growth of the field. But we were very delighted to hear when that paper came out from your colleagues at ELOSA and with Ben Rome. And we'll make sure everyone has access to that. But back to
Great,
you, Jerry.
great. Thank you. So on the larger frame, these are, as I said to people in our division at Harvard a couple of weeks ago, the worst times that I've lived through in terms of health policy.
Wow.
And a colleague said, you know, don't say that in front of the junior faculty and the research staff. It'll depress them. But frankly, they knew it before I said it. That, you know, having
Of
lived through,
course.
you know, the Nixon era and the Reagan cutbacks and all the craziness of the strange policies we've had over the last 40 to 50 years that I've been in medicine, it's never been this bad. So
Wow.
that is getting ready for the nugget of hope that you asked for.
Yes, please.
And at that presentation we had at the division about 2 or so weeks ago, my colleague Aaron Kesselheim chose to find one of the more positive statements in my book, which we'll chat about in a second, which was in effect paraphrasing myself. Governments come and go, and we have processes for correcting the course, at least so far, if we don't think government is on the right path. But there are some concepts and values and facts that are pretty much eternal in medicine, or at least eternal in the last 50 or 100 years of medicine. And that is that facts matter, evidence matters, we have tools to know what we ought to be doing in healthcare, whether it's about quality improvement programs like academic detailing or about actual specific therapeutics, whether they be medications or vaccines or surgeries. We know, and we didn't always know this, you know, before the middle of the 20th century, people were still doing, at least in therapeutics, all kinds of zany stuff because we did not have that rigor to apply and say, how do we know this works and this doesn't work? We got good at that around the literally as late as the 1950s and 60s. We now do it more or less routinely. And we've also, at least until this year, we're reasonably okay at trying to implement those tools to look at health systems issues, what works and what doesn't. We're still maybe 75 years behind the curve on that kind of implementation, but we're learning. And so the tools are there, and no one can ever make them go away. And it is similar to the rules of evidence in science. You know, they are there even if one has temporarily a government that either doesn't understand or doesn't want to believe the evidence about therapeutics, including vaccines, and just kind of blows all that off. That doesn't mean that the tools have disappeared. And I'm hoping, as my the ray of hope that you requested, Bevan, is that we will at some point, when we look back, maybe a year from now, at the havoc that is being created on a daily basis in terms of our healthcare system, in terms of sowing doubt about treatments that work, about taking away coverage for things that are actually helping people, particularly disadvantaged populations. And when it is clear to everybody, as it will be within a year, how devastating it is to turn our backs on the very well-established rules of science and evidence and fairness and good policy when we see the damage that that has already begun to create and will do so even more in just the next several months. I'm hoping that there will be a course correction when people say, well, you know, I wanted limited government, but I didn't mean that. Or I wanted to push back against X or Y, but I didn't mean that. And we will, I hope, in the end of 2025, maybe the first half of 2026, have the American public look at the consequences of ignoring science, ignoring equity, ignoring access, and see what the results are, and maybe say, we don't think we want to keep doing that anymore. So that is my ray of hope that is unfortunately not going to kick in for many months to a year, but I guess you got to believe that we're going to get it right, because how could we not?
So steering so far off the course, you're hoping for a course correction, for a throwing the wheel in the other direction and just kind of getting back to some semblance of sanity there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're hoping for that too. We all are, especially those folks who are listening to this podcast who we know are big proponents of evidence-based medicine. I can't help but sneak in a question based on what you were just talking about, just for my own edification, but I know there are a lot of folks, especially our NARCAD director, Mike Fisher, who are just absolute nerds about medical history, all of the zany things you were talking about prior to the rigor. Can you throw a couple of fun things at us that used to be par for the course in terms of medical treatments that were not at all evidence-based, just so we can have some surprise and maybe some hope that, hey, if that used to happen, then the times we're in now can change too?
Mm-hmm. Great question. And I ask it in honor of our mutual friend, Mike, who has brought so much to the field with his, you know, his sensibleness and his gentleness and his intelligence. I mean, one thing in writing the book that we'll chat about in a sec, I was interested in going back and realizing that certainly within my lifetime, that is, you know, 1962, although I was still, you know, not very far along in my career, but there was a time before some very important legislation when any drug company could market any drug they wanted without being required to show that it worked. And, you know, we assume that, of course, a drug company's got to do studies. We may or may not love the studies, but they can't just say, here's my product, put it on the market. And it was a heroic woman at the FDA named Frances Kelsey, who was one of their early physician investigators there, who refused to approve a drug because she said, there's not enough efficacy and safety evidence here. And she was met with this remarkably familiar retort by the industry saying, you know, you're going to stifle our developing new drugs, and by libertarians who said, you're denying the freedom of doctors and patients to take what they want to take. But she held fast, and the drug, as it turns out, was thalidomide. And in demanding better evidence and not approving the drug at FDA until she got it, she spared tens of thousands of women and babies and fathers the misery of having a bad fetal malformation that the drug caused. And the fact that, so, you know, I take comfort in a number of those things. One is that the country was largely spared a bad epidemic of birth defects. Second was that there was recognition that FDA has got some important work to do in reviewing drugs before they are approved. And realizing that because of that, that resulted in indirectly in the passage of a law that says, yes, FDA can demand evidence about efficacy and safety before it will let a manufacturer market a drug. And that was the first time any government anywhere on earth had made that requirement. And then countries just followed suit all around the globe and set up their own FDA-like entity. So that is sort of a kind of macro zaniness that was present not all that long ago in terms of American history. And I think we all, for at least the last 50, 60 years, have benefited from that. How much of that gets undone at the moment, we don't yet know. But, you know, it was one of those, was it ever really like that? And the answer is, yeah, it was.
It's wild to think about. It's wild to think about that. It's wild to think about, things like trepanning and leeches and all of the bloodletting. And so we are happy to hear that, of course, in a relatively short period of time, things have moved forward. And so thinking of moving forward, we're really excited to talk about your new book. So of course we love the original book. And if you have yet to read Jerry's first book, Jerry, can you give a little plug for your first book before we get into the second one,
Sure,
which does
happy to.
have,
And it is still in print. It is still available on Amazon. It's called Powerful Medicines: The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. And while it is now years and years old, there are issues in there that are still, I guess, both sadly and happily, still very relevant to the issues we're facing now. But the new one, Bevan, as you mentioned, is called Rethinking Medications: Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. And it was just published by Simon and Schuster at the end of April and is available every place you can get books. We put together a neat website for the book that's called rethinkmeds.info. And Bevan can put these links on the podcast, but it's rethinkmeds.info. And it's a way also for readers to interact with me, with each other about the topics in the book, because I was hoping that besides being a fascinating read about how do we know what we know about how we use drugs, who's doing what to whom, politically, commercially, scientifically, it's also, I hope, going to be opening the door for people to think about these issues in their own practice, in their own lives, in their own programs, and maybe even ideally connect up with one another through the rethinkmeds.info website. Because I had a lot of fun writing it, and I wrote it so that it would be fun to read as well, or listen to. I recorded the audiobook in my own voice as well. So people who are into jogging or commuting and have a lot of time, but not sitting down to read, there's that modality as well.
We love that. We love that so much. So yeah, check it out on Amazon, Audible. You can also get it at a variety of other sites if you do a quick Google search. I'm on rethinkmeds.info right now and loving so much all the different options you have there, particularly the piece where all of your end notes and references are in one spot and clickable. I love the space for readers to connect with each other and communicate with you. Which is so important because all of the content in both of your books need to be continuously discussed. It's not just something that sits in a book and then it is what it is. It's very much a living, breathing collection of content. And I really, really enjoyed reading it. I just finished it last week and also was delighted to see a chapter dedicated to academic detailing, which, of course, is one of the big topics that we focus on here at Changing Minds, along with really any evidence-based behavior change. Of course, we hope for behavior change all of the time when it is based on the evidence, what the evidence says we should do. But I want to call out a quote that you placed at the very beginning of your new book in chapter one, and it's from a book about the Soviet Union called "This Is Not Propaganda." The quote reads, "We have access to more information and evidence than ever, but facts seem to have lost their power." Jerry, do you think this is true given what's going on right now in the States? Or do you think it's just a matter of turning away from the facts? Tell us a little bit more about that quote, why you chose it, and how we can explore it.
Okay, and it'll be interesting to note that I found and plucked out that quote about 2 or maybe 3 years ago as I was starting to work on the book, well before the elections of November 2024. And it was not in reaction to the current scene. In fact, a lot of the book was already in place, although I did get to make some passing references to the current situation. But that goes back a couple of years. And of course, the guy who wrote it was writing about the Soviet Union, which goes back even further. And I think to answer your question, Bevan, it comes down to the issue of how different societies at different points in time think about facts and evidence. And sometimes they are seen with reverence and people understand that whether it is medicine or astronomy or cooking or social policy, our best guide in this very complicated world we live in is good evidence, and how did it get discovered, and who derived it, and did they get it right? And that is how, bit by bit, we have been able to build up a functioning healthcare system, and or mostly functioning healthcare system, and all the other sciences, but also public policy. You know, we try to steer away from daffy things that are ideologically driven but don't make any sense on the ground. And so what began to do in the Soviet Union, and we all know what happened to them as a government, was the idea that what mattered was not facts, but what mattered was what the authorities said was true. And sadly, we are now in a period, I hope a temporary period, in which what is true is not what the researchers or the clinicians on the ground or the program managers or the scientists say is true, using time-tested rules of evidence and experimentation, if possible, but rather what the leaders tell us is true. And we're seeing that on so many fronts, and the listeners know far better than I all the different ways this is playing out. And I think our only hope is to say, wait a minute, can we please just go back to saying what is true is what is established by respected methods, and not because the dear leader tells us it's true. And to the extent that we can get back to that respect for facts and evidence, it may be a way out of the jungle, both in terms of how we do healthcare, but also how we do government.
I think people really need to be thinking about this and feeling like, feeling like there is, just going back to the hope piece, that facts really are their compass, that facts really are their anchor. And I know that that's something that we're really focusing on here at NARCAD at next month's annual summit. It's a virtual event that we hope you'll all attend. Please do check it out and register on narcad.org. Jerry, let's wrap up with one more question. Of course, I would love to ask you a million more, but just given that we have a period of time here we got to stick to, even though I'd rather not, what do you see as being an ideal future or expansion of academic detailing? If AD could kind of take over a little more than it already is, be something more well-known and more familiar to folks, how would you like people to see it? And what do you see it doing in your ideal future?
Okay, thanks for that. I think it's really pretty straightforward. And that is, I would love for doctors, patients, healthcare systems, and governments to all agree on one very obvious fact, and that is that patients do better when we give them evidence-based treatments that have been well studied, and that healthcare systems do better when we use those, and ideally if we can put in a layer of looking at cost-effectiveness as well, and that if we were all able, and this really sadly or fortunately goes back to that first gleam in my eye in 1979, if we could just bring all medication use and other healthcare interventions, but medications are our first love here, all medication use up to the level of what the best available science tells us, the best available evidence, is the best thing for patients and also, ideally, the most cost-effective or affordable, and bring in that insight as opposed to just kind of whatever the commercial said that the patient saw last night, or the sales rep said, or the insurer said they were willing to cover because of some rebate they got, and just let it be sort of the gold standard North Star is the evidence is our best guide to the best possible care. Let's use that, which frankly is a lot like just saying, you know, the rule of law is the best way to run a society. Let's use that instead of having people make up or distorting the law as they go ahead. We also don't want to distort the evidence as we go ahead. And if we could do that, not only would people get better care and have better outcomes, but healthcare systems would also be able to have lower expenditures because we're using a lot of crap that's expensive and doesn't really help any more than the other stuff that we could have used does. And, you know, we would deal with both our quality and our cost, and by virtue of that, our access issues, if we could just have more people getting the evidence. And as we all know who are fans of academic detailing, you don't get better use of evidence by mailing people memos or by limiting their choices. You get it by teaching clinicians how to do their job better, which frankly is the reason most of us went into healthcare in the first place, not to get memos or have our choices limited.
Anybody who got into healthcare to get more memos, we don't know what's up with you, but you're probably not listening to this right now. For those right. of you that are our fellow ambassadors of the evidence, the folks that know what Jerry said is the truth, that evidence is that North Star. Thank you for being with us here today. And Jerry, thank you for spending some time with us. We're so excited to have you on today. And for folks listening, if you have any thoughts, reflections for Jerry, please pass them along to us at narcad@bmc.org or pop on over to Jerry's new book website. We'll make sure you have all the links for all the great stuff we talked about here today right under the podcast description. So scroll down for that. Jerry, so grateful to have you and looking forward to book number three. But right now, right now, let's just coast on the success of book number two. And folks, go on and get that book either from Amazon or Thrift Books or your local library or audible.com. Thanks, Jerry. Right.
And thank you, Bevan. And if anybody reads the book and likes it, it would be great if you could tell folks about it in your social media accounts or comments on the book's website or on Amazon or any other website to just kind of, it's all about spreading the word. And that's my goal for the moment is really spreading the word about the book and in turn about academic detailing and health policy.
Yes, and getting people thinking, using their minds and not just taking in what people tell them as facts, but checking it out for yourself. So thanks again, everyone. Looking forward to the next episode, and Jerry, we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Bevan.